Trib Live is made possible by AT&T, IBC Bank, NRG, and Christus Health.
Please join me in welcoming the Honorable Kirk Watson. Hal, good to see you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Come on. Okay.
All right.
Thank you all.
A hero in your own hometown, and all they give you is a bathroom.
Yeah, that, well, you know.
How's that working?
If anybody needs to go to the Kirk, go now.
The Kirk. I think there is something just awesome about them referring to the bathroom as the Kirk.
Well,
I just think that's so great.
My parents would be very, very proud.
They sure would. All that hard work for
that's
this.
That's right.
Let's begin with the news of yesterday. So yesterday, the state leaders, the governor, lieutenant governor, and speaker, announced the results of their budget cutting exercise. They had asked back in January state agencies to cut their budgets by 5%. The total cuts submitted, we know, were $1.7 billion, but they made some exemptions for things like hospital beds and Homeland Security and all that, and they got down to $1.2 billion. You told Kate Alexander of the Statesman today, or for today's paper, that the era of something for nothing has now been shown to be ridiculous. Could you talk a little bit about your view of that?
Yeah, I think you need to kind of put it in an overall context.
Yeah.
Look, we're in a mess.
Yeah.
This budget cycle, I mean, it is a big mess. I hear people trying to minimize it all the time.
Yeah.
They minimize it by saying, it's just a simple math problem, or, we'll just tighten our belt, or something like that. But it's a mess both procedurally and actually.
Yeah.
Part of it is, right now, people can't even tell you how deep the hole is. We know we can't see the bottom of it, but we don't know where that is. And I find that, both from a procedural standpoint and an actual standpoint, a real problem.
Why is that? We still don't know some things that will ultimately tell us the size of the hole, right?
Well, I think that's part of it, but I also think it's part of the process that we follow that I think is symptomatic of what we saw with this little round that we went through of so-called budget cuts. And part of the problem is that we don't have a process set up. And we're a $180+ billion enterprise that meets once every 2 years, and we sprint to try to get a budget passed. But during the rest of that time, we're not doing some of the very things that ought to be done to keep people up to date on it. So that, for example, what you have is a process that was created with this 5% situation where the big three say, hey, we're going to do cuts. Now, there's no real process to that. There's no real public input to that. There's really almost no legislative input to that. And so what happens is we don't even know what the values are that go into making those decisions.
Why should there be public input, frankly? Why should there be legislative input? The agency heads are responsible for their budgets. They're asked to cut 5%. They submit 5% cuts. Why is that not the appropriate way to go at this?
Well, because for a variety of reasons. Let's start with this.
Yeah.
You've got a budget that ought to be the basis of the values of our state.
Right.
So if you're going to come in and you're going to start making cuts, and by the way, let me start off by saying this. I think a process of always knowing where your first 5% is going to come is a very good process. I think that in good times and bad times, it is appropriate and something we ought to do is know how much and where we might first make cuts. But we ought to do that based upon some sort of value proposition. And my value proposition would be first and foremost, and this actually, frankly, is my value proposition in looking at budgets where you're doing anything. But it ought to be, you know, people first. How are we going to invest in Texans? And by the way, the flip side of that, of course, is what are we going to cut? But how are we going to invest in Texans so that we move forward? Everything from early childhood all the way through higher ed. What's the metrics that we will use to determine whether we're getting any form of return on investment, cuts or otherwise, revenue or cuts or whatever? How do we make sure it's transparent? How do we make sure that those who are elected to help make the decisions on behalf of people know what's going on? And frankly, how do the people know what's going on? And then I think, so that you can also have some transparency and accountability in there. And then the other thing about it is we ought to be looking at how it is we can assure that we have some sort of reliability to balancing the budget. We're in this mess, in my view, because for too long, our budgeting process has been based upon what I call the three D's of budgeting. debt, diversions, and delay. We are using far more debt than we were using even a decade ago. In fact, and transportation being a big part of that,
which we'll come to.
Yeah, a decade ago, we didn't we were pay as you go, but we're not that way. Diversions. There's a whole lot that goes on where in the budgeting process where taxpayers think they're giving money for something, and they expect to get something in return for those tax dollars, but the money gets spent on something else. And then delay. And the delay is that over and over again, it's about how we can kick the can down the road, how we can avoid making the kinds of decisions that that have been promised to the taxpayers. And of course, the best example of that, I guess, is really twofold. One is the 2006 so-called tax swap, where there was a property tax cut, and it was supposed to be replaced by the so-called business tax or margins tax, whatever you want to call it. And the other is the use of stimulus money. And so that delays making the hard decisions.
Well, the lieutenant governor said last week in this very room that he didn't believe it required stimulus money to balance the budget. He disagrees with you that the stimulus was a delay tactic. Have I set that softball in front of you high enough on an arc there?
Well, I guess coulda, woulda, shoulda, you know.
Is he wrong?
Well, I suppose I could be playing in an NBA finals right now if I weren't 4 foot tall, you know. Here's what happened. There's no denying that billions of dollars of stimulus money, depending upon who you listen to, you know, around $12 billion of stimulus money was used to balance that budget. About $6.4 billion of it was money that everybody seems to be willing to admit, directly replaced general revenue. The rest of that money, that stimulus money, went for what some say are one-time programs. I think the old mayor in me sees that as really expanding your base budget, but I'll even go along with that argument. It was balanced, 6.4 of that, or roughly 6.4, around that neighborhood, was used to directly offset general revenue. There were many of us pointing out that is what we're doing here. So it's hard to
say. And that's not going to be available this time.
It's not going to, unless somebody thinks that Washington's really looking to help Texas this next time. I can't imagine that's going to be available.
You don't think?
That red phone on the governor's desk, I'm not sure is going
to
ring.
Let me come back to this issue of the $1.2 billion. So we had five things, I believe, that were exempted yesterday: hospital beds, Homeland Security, public safety, workforce development, and financial aid for college students. You support all those exemptions from the budget cuts?
From what I know, yeah, sure. I think I do, and I think they fall into the kind of the value proposition that I'm talking about. Here's part of what concerns me. There are only three ways you fill the hole.
Right.
Cash, cuts, and the kitty, the rainy day fund.
Yeah.
So the question then becomes, how are we going to go about doing that? And
good. Tell me. I keep asking this of people, and they keep kind of doing this. But the reality is, if we don't want to cut out of line with the values that you articulate, then you're either going to have to raise taxes, or you're going to have to drain the rainy day fund, or both.
Well, let me just say this.
Please tell us.
Well, let me say categorically. Yeah. I'm going to say this as clearly as I think I'm capable of saying something. I will not vote for any new taxes. And I won't vote to take from the rainy day fund until the state of Texas engages in a budget reform process, maybe not even then, but as a fundamental principle, we have dug such a deep hole by engaging in budget games that I can't look at anybody in this audience and tell you that if we were to raise a tax that maybe even need to make, we might even agree with each other, might need to be raised. I can't promise you that that tax will be used for what you believe it will be used for. And I will not vote to increase a tax under those circumstances.
But if you knew that the taxes would be used for the reason that you were told, you would support one?
You can't ask that question.
Well, I just did.
Well, then let me rephrase that. I ain't answering that question.
Now that's transparency right there.
And I ain't answering it for this reason. I believe that's part of the way we've gotten ourselves in this trouble. We come back session after session and try to put Band-Aids. What would you do this time? What would you do that time? And the Band-Aids are all washing off. I think what we ought to be doing is we ought to be taking it down to the base. And we ought to be looking at how it is we're going to rebuild that base, mm-hmm. where we look at it based upon some values, and we take the time to do it. That's the other thing. You didn't ask this, but I'll say it this way. When I got into the legislature 3 years ago now, I was amazed at how we went about doing the budgeting process. You know, if cities budgeted this way, we'd be passing laws to outlaw cities.
Well, cities don't only work for 140 blank days every 2 years.
There you have it. Yeah. There you have it. Yeah. And I actually think that's part of the problem. I think we are in such a mess, and the lack of transparency and a lack of accountability on the budgeting process is so significant, I think it's worth taking the extra time. So that when you ask that question again, you can actually put it in a context. Yeah. And this can be done. There are groups out there, everyone from McKinsey to Pew Center for the States to others, that you can read and we can learn how to go about doing this. But I'm not going to go into this legislative. I go into this legislative session that's coming up telling you that my vote will not be there for taxes. My vote will not be there
for the rainy day fund
right. until we have real budget reform.
So tell me how you're different from Governor Perry then. Because what the governor has said is, yes, we have a shortfall of $15, $16, $18 billion. We will not raise taxes. We will not drain the rainy day fund. We're going to accomplish getting that number down to zero or close to zero in 11, the same way we did in 03, which is by cutting. So if you're taking taxes off the table completely, you're taking the rainy day fund off the table completely, how are you different than the governor?
I'm different than the governor, first of all.
Other than shooting kittens, yeah, apparently, that there would be, or coyotes, or whatever.
I did not shoot a kitten. Those were rats.
Rats, pardon me.
I was protecting the kitten.
I should have asked you if you were packing today, actually. I only scan your emails. I'm sorry. Yeah, I don't read them.
Well, you get enough. Frankly.
I get enough. Yeah.
Other than that and my bald spot, here's how I'm different. First of all, one of the great Texas myths is that in 2003, it was done with cuts. There were a lot of cuts. But if you actually look at the cuts of 2003, a big part of the cuts was roughly the kinds of numbers we were talking about just yesterday with that. They were cuts. For all the damage that was done in cutting in the area of health, including children's health and the Children's Health Insurance Program, it only amounted to a couple of, and this is real money, and I, you know, when the video comes out and somebody says $1 billion, and he doesn't, I mean, that's real money. But in the hole that we're talking about and trying to balance it, it wasn't a big amount by comparison or relative to the hole that we were in. What happened is you saw a number of things where there were some taxes involved, and there was a lot of shifting of who pays for what. For example, you may remember that in 2003 there was the I think it was called the Telecommunications Infrastructure Fund, or fee. Called the TIF, the Telecommunications Infrastructure Fee. That was a fee that was supposed to go away. Well, it didn't. Those in the room that live with that, it didn't. In fact, it was renewed as part of a tax or fee. There was a tax amnesty thing that was put together during that period of time that allowed a lot of money to come in. But then there was also some shifting that occurred. One of the big shifts, of course, was the deregulation of tuition in higher education. And what that did was it was a shift of how money is basically collected for those state institutions. You also saw other shifts. I mean, local school districts were faced with hundreds of millions of dollars of having to pick up health benefits for retired teachers. So it's important to note that in the rhetoric that we hear about, this is part of what I say, debt, diversions, delay, and I guess you could say decoys. Decoys are thrown into this as an effort to try to say, we're doing something, we're giving you something for nothing, when in fact that's not what happened. And of course, we see with college tuition, it's gone up.
Are you advocating for the re-regulation of tuition?
Not under the current circumstances. I think you have to keep the flexibility. Look, here's the question on tuition. When we talk about tuition at higher ed, we have to talk about it not just in the context of tuition at higher ed. We have to talk about it in the context of the state budget. It is a budgetary issue. I frankly am concerned. From an economic development standpoint, I'm very fearful that we're not doing the kinds of things we ought to be doing in higher ed. And that's not just BAs and BBAs and engineering degrees. That includes graduate medical education and all those sorts of things. We're not doing the things in higher ed we ought to be doing in order to prepare our state for productivity and growth in our economy over the middle haul and the long haul. So, at a real time when we're worried about are we getting the numbers we need in higher ed, at the very same time, we're seeing increases in tuition that make it difficult. So I think what we ought to be doing is we ought to be focusing on allow for the flexibility. But the only way to assure that we don't overprice our schools so that we actually are working against our long-term future is we need to make sure that in the budgeting process there's a balance there and that balance allows for those tuition costs to not be more than they ought to be. So it requires the flexibility at the tuition level at the colleges, but it also requires that we be doing our job at the legislature to make sure that there's appropriate state funding.
Right, but there's not likely to be more appropriate state funding for that or frankly for anything this year.
I think that's probably an accurate statement. Yeah. And look, it's one of the things that concerns me about the economics of our state. Here's the situation. We are a state that is doing better than others right now economically.
You acknowledge that because the governor brags, as you know, and other people brag around the governor about how the state is relative to other states significantly better off. You don't dispute that.
No. I kind of pride myself on getting economic development. I was mayor of a city that was. Austin was Forbes and Fortune, both named it the best city or place in America to do business while I was mayor. Some magazine called Texas Monthly Biz Magazine. Named me best mayor in Texas for business. I was chair of the chamber. I've worked to create jobs. No less of economic development guy than Rick Perry recently said at a public event that this senator gets economic development. I think we are doing better. I worry that in Texas right now we focus really on only one aspect of being business friendly, and it's an important aspect. We are a low tax state, and in my view, I'll tell you from an economic development guy who considers himself an economic development guy, we need to stay a low tax state. I've seen it work in terms of creating jobs and productivity and growth, but we also need to be an economic development friendly state because we're investing in Texans and making sure that we're doing, and when I say investing in Texans both from higher ed, which is what got me off on this, but also investing in the infrastructure that we're going to need in order to carry out that economy. Things like roads,
right?
Things like water. So we're doing better than other places. We can't, but that doesn't mean we can't do better. We're doing better, and sometimes I worry that some of our leadership thinks we're doing better solely because we're just pretty. And we're somehow doing it on our own. The truth of the matter is, we're doing better in part because people before us made significant investment in the infrastructure that we inherited. Everybody in this room inherited excess capacity in our road systems, in higher ed, in water, in those kinds of things. And I am significantly, well, I say this all the time, I am very worried that the Preston Watsons of the world, who's my 20-year-old sophomore in college, 30 years from now, he will be roughly the age I am today, a very young man. He will be roughly my age. And here's the question. Will he be part of the first generation of Texans that doesn't inherit any excess capacity as they try to make their economic health and economic wealth? Will they be faced with having to build the infrastructure and compete globally because we didn't do what we should have done to pass something on?
Well, let's talk about roads. You mentioned roads a couple of times now. So Deirdre DeLisi, the Commissioner DeLisi, who's the chair of the Texas Transportation Commission, was here a few weeks ago. She identified the size of the road funding hole as fairly significant.
Yeah, like $315 billion.
And obviously, there's just not the money available right now. No one's got money sort of stashed away to take care of this. You're the vice chair of the Transportation and Homeland Security Committee. You know this issue. So what do we do? What's your advice to her on how we solve that problem? How do you fill the hole?
Well, it's always intriguing to me that part of this hole got dug by some of the folks that are now saying we're in a hole. And
it doesn't make it less of a hole. It's still a hole.
No, it's just that it's hard to be both the victim and the perpetrator.
Well, stay with the victim for the moment.
Yeah, yeah. But here's the situation. The primary area where we get our funding for transportation is what's known as the motor fuels tax. The motor fuels tax is a user fee. It is a user fee that those who use our roads and need to buy gas in order to use the roads, they pay. And it has been frozen at the same rate, it's not even a rate, same price since 1991. So what that means is that today, when you go put a gallon of gas in your car, you pay exactly the same amount in terms of that motor fuel user fee as you paid back in 1991. Well, there's a big problem with that. And the problem, of course, is that the cost of building road capacity and maintaining roads has gone up since 1991. So we've got a problem with that.
Now, taxes off the table this morning.
Well, and let me just tell you, I wasn't the one that took motor fuel taxes off the table. That is not something that you have seen any movement. So one of the things that I supported last session was if the state's not going to do its job, if the state is going to abdicate its responsibility, then get out of the way and let local communities.
This is a local control.
Let local communities. And, of course, maybe that's the old Mary and me there, too. But the truth of the matter is, get out of the way. Allow for local communities to have options for different ways that they might raise revenue. And for those that don't know, there was legislation that was carried last session that would have allowed for a local option. And what it would have done is it would have given a menu list of different ways, you know, motor vehicle fees, additional gas tax locally, those kinds of things. And then it would have said if the county commissioner's court creates projects, it has to identify the projects, and it also then has to identify how you're going to fund those projects, and then the voters have to vote to do it. Kind of like what we've done with bond elections for a long period of time.
So if you guys care enough about your roads and putting money in to fill this hole, then you vote to raise taxes.
That's right.
And if you don't raise taxes, then you get the roads that you're willing to pay for.
That's right. Now, look, that won't cover everything,
right?
But at least it allows for local communities to do some of the projects. The other thing I worry about on something like that is it creates winners and losers. Some parts of the state, they'll have those elections. They'll be able to build that infrastructure. Other parts of the state won't. Right. And I think the state ought to do a better job of dealing with the entire state. But that's one example.
But isn't this, how is this any different than what you just described earlier of the state essentially abdicating its responsibility and kicking the can down, in this case, a literal road? State doesn't want to deal with the hard question, so we're just going to kick the can down to the cities. It's their problem, and if they don't vote for it, too bad.
It's not.
It's not any different. I mean, it's exactly the same
thing. No, it's not. But at some point, I don't want to hold a gun to the head of the local communities because I'm looking around and I'm saying, okay, well, the state's doing such a poor job, and I don't believe it ought to kick the can down the road. I'm going to victimize you a second time.
Right. All right. Let me move away from policy while we have 10 or so minutes left and ask you about politics. Rasmussen polls.
I thought that's what we were talking
about. Well, we're talking about a different kind. We're talking about kind of horse race as opposed to the substance of politics. Rasmussen poll early this week had Bill White down by 13 points against Rick Perry, 51-38. You believe that's a legitimate snapshot of the race?
I think that's
why?
First of all, it doesn't fit in every other public poll you've seen. I think there's been, I haven't counted them, so I may be off, but 5, 6, or 7 different public polls that have had the governor less than 50%.
Many of them conducted by the same polling firm.
Yeah.
Why did you like those and don't like this one?
Well, I mean, I just look at, frankly, because I think it's an outlier. I mean, it's one of those situations where, and you see that in polling. I mean, we see that all the time. And I just think it's an outlier. It's one of those that there have been polls that have come out, I mean, like yesterday, I think one poll was put out by, now granted it was put out by a Democratic
firm had Perry up only by 9.
Yeah, and had Perry down below 50%, which by the way is, as you know, an important number for an incumbent governor who has just come through a primary where he has spent millions of dollars. You would expect a governor that's not under the gun under these circumstances. We've used the phrase gun a lot today.
We have.
Yeah. But he's not under the gun to be in better position. Even on that what I consider to be an outlier poll, he's only at 51%.
Right.
And so I think that's probably an outlier.
The number I'm focusing on, and I want to ask you to focus on, is the 38%. Do you think Mayor White has run a good campaign so far? Is he the candidate you hoped he would be?
He is the candidate I expected him to be, and he is running a campaign that I think puts him in a position to win this race. Look,
you don't share the concern of some on the left that Mayor White has not been aggressive enough in attacking Governor Perry. Jason Stanford, the campaign manager for Chris Bell, wrote a piece in the Tribune that was then followed by a piece by Bob Moser in the Texas Observer, in both cases making the same argument. Mayor White, it's time for you to kick Governor Perry in his business right now. What are you waiting for? Get going on this.
I like Jason.
Yeah.
But we ain't calling Chris Bell Governor Bell right now.
Take issue with Jason Stanford. Take issue with Jason Stanford, but Bob Moser of The Observer followed it up with a very similar column, again, criticizing the White campaign not being aggressive.
Here's part of the reason I think, a couple things about this. Bill White, one of the reasons I like Bill White is a very business-like candidate. He is somebody that I think when people come to know him, and it's a big old state, and it's still 6 months away, and I've run statewide, as you pointed out, and I appreciate you pointing out
I didn't
out
say
that.
Unsuccessfully, yeah, I just noted that you ran.
They ain't calling me general today. But one of the great lessons of 2002 was it's a big old state, and it takes a long time to get well known. And as you know, Bill, while extremely and very positively well known in the Houston media market, which by the way is a big deal in this race, he's not as well known in the rest of the state. He is making himself known. And I think when people see, hear of his record and see Bill, I don't think he's going to be the kind of aggressive candidate that we all expect to see in politics where you got to bang heads together. I think what they're going to want, I think part of the fatigue that people in this state are feeling right now is they want somebody that will get involved in the details. Somebody that will roll up their sleeves and spend time. I mean, that's what we need. Bill White, and I shouldn't probably say this, but because I'm not sure he will fully appreciate it, but Bill White's a nerd.
For the headline of this conversation.
But that's a good thing. Bill White is going to be the kind of governor that will take the time to understand the details, and I don't think he needs to be what we all tend to think we want in these political campaigns, which is who can get the biggest headlines and be the one that bashes the other side the most. It is time in Texas we had somebody who cared about the policy, was willing to be a nerd, and was willing to immerse themselves in the answers.
But he has to get into governor's office before he can do all that. Didn't he and his campaign watch the Hutchison game films? I mean, the fact is, this is setting up, is it not, very similar to the way the primary set up?
I don't think so.
You don't think that he did watch the films, or you don't think they need to?
Good point. I don't think that it's shaping up. I don't think it is shaping up to be that. I think it is shaping up to be a very significant contrast between somebody who has had a highly successful record down in the city of Houston, became highly respected by people of whatever party they identified themselves with,
right,
and who cares deeply about the issues at a time when we're really going to need somebody who cares deeply about the issues.
But of course, you ran as a nonpartisan mayor of a city in which you had the respect of people on both sides, and then you stepped out to run as a Democrat statewide, and it was a little bit of a different calculus.
Well, part of it is, but there's a real difference between running for governor and running for attorney general.
Well, people pay attention to the latter, or the governor, and not so much the attorney general.
And that's really the biggest difference. I mean, there were times during 2002 where I thought that I could have set myself on fire on the south steps of the Capitol, and I'd ended up in the next to last paragraph. By the way, he set himself on fire, and Greg would have said in the last paragraph, "That's just like him." and we would all been high-fiving in the campaign. We made it in the story.
Hey, we got in the second to last paragraph.
Look at us. There's my name.
Before we open it up for questions, let me ask you one thing on this subject, but a little bit to one side of it, which is to say the Democratic environment nationally. So last night, even our Republican friends in the room here may want to agree it was a good night in some ways for the Democrats that Joe Sestak, defeating Arlen Specter from the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, got the nomination in Pennsylvania, held the John Murtha seat in Pennsylvania. Blanche Lincoln got forced into a runoff with the lieutenant governor there. To what degree is the Democratic environment going to be a factor in this race or in all the statewide races in the fall? And if you were Bill White and Barack Obama wanted to come and campaign with you, would you be cool with it, or would you tell him to stay away?
I think it will be somewhat of a factor, but I don't think it will be as big a factor as it is in some of these other states, in part because it is Texas. And Texas...
Even at his peak, they didn't support the president.
Yeah, and Texas looks at these off-year elections or interim elections or whatever you want to call them in a different way than it looks at presidential elections. And I think Bill will have the resources, the intellect, and the ability to create a focus enough on just the governor's race that it will create the focus where it ought to be in that race.
So should the president come and campaign for Bill White?
I don't think there's any problem with that.
You would advise Mayor White that it would be his advantage to have the president.
Well,
campaign?
It will be an advantage in some instances, and it'll be a disadvantage in others. So I mean, some people look. Obama is a Texas is a football state, and Obama is a basketball president. Man, it's a big issue.
You just keep churning these out, aren't you?
It's a big issue. I'm not going to. It's 6 months away. I actually think that you're going to see some changes between now and election time that will demonstrate that a lot of what Obama has been doing has made a difference. I mean, we're already seeing job growth completely different than we saw a year ago. Public opinion typically it doesn't keep up with just the creation of jobs. It takes a little while for public opinion to catch up to some of that. I think it's going to be a different feel in late September and October than you have today even with regard to the president and Washington, D.C.
All right. Well, Senator Watson, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Great to see you. Appreciate
you
your
too.
Time.
Thank
Senator.
You.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Trip Live is made possible by AT&T, IBC Bank, NRG, and Christus Health.